Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
This episode of Hacks and Flacks was recorded on the 28th of October 2022. Rishi Sunak had just become the third British Prime Minister in 7 weeks, Suella Braverman was reappointed as Home Secretary, and Elon Musk finally closed his deal to take over Twitter, being pictured walking into the head office carrying a bathroom sink.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is the subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of Hacks and Flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of Hacks and Flacks. Hello and welcome to another deep dive into the world of Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. In the last episodes, we've all said that we must talk in depth about how Twitter has ruined the news. And that day has finally arrived. And it would seem none of the team wanted to miss out on this hashtag of an opportunity. So I'm joined by Hack Mick Booker and two flacks in the forms of Andrew McDougall and Giles Kenningham. Hello.
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 Mick, I'm going to start with you. Isn't the statement that Twitter has ruined the news a little bit dramatic?
I think it depends what day it is and what job you're in. So if I'm on a news desk on a national newspaper and we've got no stories, Twitter is brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, if you're one of these two guys and they're sitting in their dusty little offices trying, you know, making bundles of cash, not doing an awful lot for their corporate clients.
I feel seen.
And then something pops up on Twitter and one of their clients has done wrong and they need to act, then it's terrible for these two and it's brilliant for me.
Let me just take you to that point, though. You said when you're running a newspaper, not a lot of news about, and you see a tweet. How do you know that that tweet is real, that it means anything, that it has any depth to it or backbone to it?
Come on, who do you think I am? I'm a journalist. I've got years of experience.
Care.
I know straight away. Well, first of all, I look at the blue tick and I think, well, sounds as though that's all right if it's coming from the horse's mouth. There's one. And then, it's already started by then, hasn't it? It's gone around the world. Whether it's a story or not, whether it's true or not, then it's a story about the story. So, you know, win-win at the end of the day. We know that some of it's just going to be a lot of old crap.
Yeah.
But there is some gems in there. And Twitter has turbocharged the news agenda. You know, whenever I think I got onto it in 2009, and I was on the Daily Star Sunday at the time, and particularly for the showbiz end of the market, it was gold, because someone like me was in a newspaper which we didn't have an awful lot of money. So all those big showbiz stories that float around, we couldn't quite get. But if they're just going to stick it all out on Twitter, it's like, wow, this is brilliant. This is the future. This is cheap. This is good, and a lot of it's really salacious.
Andrew, you're one of those people with corporate clients and you sit around doing nothing, according to Mick, and earning sackloads of cash for doing nothing. But Twitter must be a nightmare for you? When did you first realise that the world had changed?
It was actually when I was working for the Prime Minister of Canada, and I got my first call from a Mick Booker type scrolling Twitter looking for news, and saw that a cabinet minister had tweeted something a little bit fruity and said, I'm going to do a story about this. And then I knew I was kind of fucked because, you know, how many MPs, ministers, how many tweets do they put out a day? And I have to police that as well. It's not enough that I have to worry about what they're going to say about government business in the government line. Now I have to worry if they decide to pick a fight with a teenager in their constituency, which happened online. Oh. I had a senator, so our House of Lords is Senate, and he decided to quite cleverly call a journalist a bitch because her surname was Ditchburn, and he thought he'd be clever by calling her Bitchburn for something he wrote, and I had to get on the phone, take time out of my day to ring him up and say that maybe this wasn't the best use of his time, since he was there on a lifetime sinecure getting paid very well to do very little, that maybe he didn't need to blow up my life. And he told me to fuck off. And I had to remind him that I wasn't calling him for pleasure. I was calling him because the man in the big chair didn't want to have to answer questions about why his representative was insulting a journalist on Twitter. And that's the kind of distraction. So what changed for me was the instantaneous nature. Usually there's a filter applied. So when you're in public life or when you're on a news desk, there are stages and filters before the information gets out there. Now it's just bleh, out it goes. And that impulse and poor impulse control, particularly amongst politicians and celebrities, they don't think before they talk. And the key is to put that buffer between them. And that's half of our job, Giles and me, is making sure that we're that buffer between them and the outside world. But now when it can just happen instantaneously, but then the toothpaste is out of the tube and you're scrambling and it's very hard to pack it back or unwind it. And that's when you know things change, because it comes from everywhere all the time and instantaneously. And there's nobody in this world that's perfect in the first draft of their copy, whether that's a thought or actual copy.
And you can't delete it. People think you can delete a tweet.
Oh, it lives forever.
But you can't.
And even like there are automated bots now that will like what MP said what. And so they kind of clip this stuff automatically. And journalists that are smart have every MP on a feed through TweetDeck or whatever, just to track. Or even somebody lower down on the desk, the intern, will just sit there and kind of look for stupid stuff that people have said, because it is a story now. And it counts as a story when this person tweeted that and then I put 80 tweets dunking on them. That's copy now. Like, that's a story you see, especially in sports journalism now. You see, like, player tweeted this and then there was a pylon. Like, who the fuck cares? Like, what does that matter to me in my day?
Yeah.
And yet it's taking up my time and energy and attention. And whether you're doing a job like Giles and myself or doing Mick's job, I mean, that's a lot of time.
Giles, but how do you police it?
I mean, it has destroyed the productivity of politicians who spend far too much time on this platform putting anodyne comments out and then having to apologize. For me, what really summed up was Sajid Javid, when he was health secretary during COVID, put out, I mean, I paraphrase here, a line sort of saying, we won't bow down to this killer disease. And it was perceived to be that, you know, that was disrespectful to families of the victims. And so he then had to apologize. So I'm like, you've just wasted 2 hours. Now, what he said, I thought was perfectly fine. It probably needed more context around it. But, you know, you have this big Twitter pile on. He then had to apologize. And it was like, look, why did you bother saying that in the first place? You should have said it in the context of a broadcast interview or a newspaper interview where you can give some context to it. My other bugbear with Twitter, which is something that Andrew and I discuss regularly, is far too many journalists are expressing a view on Twitter. They are not there to express a view. If they are a commentator, fair enough. But I remember speaking to an unnamed lobby hack who said, well, it's all about my brand. And it's like, well, no, it's not about your brand. It's not about you. Anything that you guys should be doing are posting stories. We shouldn't know what your political leanings are and which way you go. And if I could read out a tweet which I saw this week from Matt Fry of Channel 4 News. Now, Channel 4 News have had a lot of issues around objectivity. Christian Guru Murphy, their presenter, has been suspended. Now, this is a family podcast, but for calling Steve Baker, the Northern Ireland Minister, a see you next Tuesday live on air. This is Matt Fry, Channel 4 News presenter. He tweets at PMQs. Now, he basically paraphrases Sunak. So, I know the Right Honourable Gentleman rarely leaves North London at Rishi Sunak. So he's talking about Rishi Sunak trying to get Keir Starmer on metropolitan elitism. A tricky one coming from an ex-Goldman Sachs PM worth 730 million. He's expressing a view. Mm. Like, Matt, we're not asking you to get involved in a class warfare. You're casting a judgment there. Now, that's for the public. If Matt Fry was a commentator or a columnist, absolutely fine. Now, for me, Channel 4 News is going down the absolute toilet. I mean, I don't know why any politician would ever want to go on that programme. How can Christian Guruamurthy come back and present on there? If I was a Tory politician being interviewed by him, I'd say, oh, Christian, we know what you think about the Tories.
Yeah.
You think we'll see you next Tuesday. So, you know, what's the point? How does he have any credibility with the public? He should be fired. I don't know why they haven't fired him.
And it doesn't take that much. It doesn't have to be that overt too. And when Trump came to power, that was illustrating for me in that you would see British journalists, Canadian journalists, American journalists, even the choice of stuff that you retweet gives someone like Giles and me an insight into how you see the world and what you do. It doesn't have to be you actually putting your own words on top of it. If I notice that you journalist that's a straight news reporter only retweet stories that are very critical of Donald Trump, you know, that gives us an insight into how you see the world. If you're a journalist, you should want to give nothing away to Giles and myself in our jobs, because it gives us the excuse to do the Channel 4 and go like, I know where you're coming from.
I tweet pictures of my dog because that's
safer,
it.
Isn't it?
It's safer.
See, now I've moved from newspapers to television now at GB News. Now, GB News comes with the fact that it's the free speech people's channel. So the presenters, particularly the primetime presenters on GB News, you don't necessarily have to patrol their Twitter because they are there to speak their minds and they're more commentary. Obviously, we've got to look at what the reporters do and with a mind to that. And obviously, with Ofcom rules and things like that, we don't want to end up in a row over impartiality in terms of what we do. But I have noticed, particularly during what's happened with Liz Truss, more and more reporters on other, because I do think, you know, the cat's out of the bag really, and they are now just commenting whenever they like, because they'd said that whatever was happening in the Commons on the night of the big vote and when they were talking about fracking, and then it would be shambles, which again,
that's opinion,
isn't it? It's not opinion, fact.
Yeah.
Well, it may have been a fact, but
it's also opinion.
That shocked me when I started seeing a number of TV reporters from, you know, the likes of ITV and places like that saying that. I think, well, no, that's, you know, you've got to keep that to yourself.
Do you have an editorial policy? Do you tell your reporters?
Yeah.
Are they governed? Do they have to pass their tweet copy past you?
They don't have to. There is trust there, and there is a social media policy, and there is an editorial charter at GB News that people have to sign up to. But
is it actively reviewed? Do you actually look at the output?
Look at it, and we make sure every 6 months or so people are reminded of it, because, you know, every now and again there can be minor problems. There's not been a huge problem that we've faced so far, but people are reminded of their duties. You know, not to make the place look bad. It's simple as that, and it's common sense. But these are getting away with it because this seems to be part of their job now.
Do you think this sort of this brain drain away from the BBC of these journalists, right? Like Emily Maitlis, John Sopel, going to Global, they now got their podcast because they want to express a view. Because from an outside of it, looks like that a bit, doesn't it? You know, obviously the BBC is
that Global offered them a heck of a lot of money, and that they don't have to report what that is. So my suspicion is that it had...
It's money. But you talk about them, they do get to express a view a bit
but
more,
who wants
don't
to
they?
Hear their opinions? I mean, this is the other thing. There's so many people talking out there with their opinion. Who wants to... I don't want to know what Emily Maitlis thinks. I really don't care.
But the algorithm does on Twitter, and that's the thing. Is the more opinion you get, the more attention you get, the more traction you get. But also the other thing with these journalists, I don't get... It ruins your legacy in a way, too. If you're Emily Maitlis and you have a reputation for being this, the second you change jobs and start spouting opinion about Brexit, about whatever, back at all the work they did and go, well, you were really the enemy throughout all this. And then you start seeing colors and shading in their work that they did. It just invites this kind of paranoia and mistrust between politicians.
But the problem was at the BBC, we already thought they were giving their opinion.
And that
had already bleeded through and leaked through. Now they've gone to doing this podcast. I've not seen a single story out of it, and it's really boring. What their opinions are, you know. Now they're free. I don't think of it. I can't think of a single opinion that's troubled any newspaper or anything.
Well, it's so orthodox, right? It's exactly what you think they'd say. They say on that podcast.
But isn't it better as a broadcaster? I've worked it for opinionated companies before, broadcasting for them. But I will reserve my opinion for when I'm working, so that people know the distinction, so that when I'm on air, I may be opinionated, but when I'm off air, I'm nothing. I'm zipped. So, Mick, coming to you, shouldn't your presenters follow the same rules, in a sense? Or do you need that traction on Twitter to point people to GB News?
No, but as I say, I think GB News was set up, there is a huge amount more comment than most other TV
well,
news channels.
Well, talk radio, at least, is about comment.
Yeah.
It's about opinion.
TV news is evolving, isn't it? And that's all part of it. And it is more of a commentary channel. We do have news presenters, news reporters as well. So there is a difference.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, we have news gathering, whereas talk necessarily don't do that or don't have the pool to do that at the moment, whereas we do. So we are very careful about it. We make sure there isn't too much of a bleed over with some of our news presenters giving commentary and doing so on Twitter as well. But again, you can't legislate for everything. And I mean, that's why there is these two exist. And this is why these two have jobs, isn't it? Because if you'd...
Because of Twitter.
Well, not because of Twitter, but it's just another...
No other reason.
But it's another complaint. Well, my old boss Richard Desmond said, if you don't have complaints, you don't have a business. So it just comes with it, and Twitter's just another arm of it to get complaints from.
Giles, can I come to you? When we look at people who tweet their opinion, let's mention Harry Cole.
Yeah.
Right. Don't they have to escalate their opinion and push the boundaries of their opinion to remain relevant? It's kind of what happened to Katie Hopkins. She had to get nastier and nastier until it did her in, because just being as nasty as you were last time isn't news.
Although Katie Hopkins wasn't a journalist, was she?
She was a commentator.
It was a search for relevance, wasn't it, at first, as she became more and more extreme.
Yeah, but don't you have to do that on Twitter to remain, to get those hits, to get that interest?
I think some people take that view, yeah. And you actually, there is a difference you see between people who just tweet out their stories, who are journalists, and those who offer commentary. Now, if they are, as I said, a columnist, that's absolutely fine. But if they are a straight news reporter, I do not want to know what your view is. You should leave your politics at the door. Equally, if it's in the world of sport or whatever else, I'm not asking you to cast judgment on these things. But I think the problem is also for journalists is they're having to report on multimedia platforms now. So, you know, they may work for a newspaper, but they'll have a podcast, dare I say it, for that newspaper. They might be video, TV stuff online. And so it's all about, as I said, they perceive to be their brand and driving numbers and having a row with someone because it does, you know, increase numbers and causes this Twitter parlance.
But that is the problem. It is this idea that I am a brand as a journalist. We talked about this on a past podcast. It's very revealing to me your motive. My motive for journalism, for journalists, should be to find the stories, to hold people accountable. That's how you make your bones in this business. Do you get the stories? Not do a bunch of people follow me on a social media platform that's not representative in any way of the general population. And how much they inject themselves into their journalism and that tells me something about them. Do they want to be celebrities? Or do they want to be hacks? And hacks, to me, get in there, are curious, don't take no for an answer, and they try to find out what people don't want found out. And that's antithetical to celebrity in social. Maybe it doesn't have to be, but it feels like too many pursue that kind of cheap hit of, look at the attention I'm getting, instead of breaking the stories that then move you up the chain and make you a political editor at a Red Top or an editor of a paper like me.
I want to ask Mick, as a hirer of journalists, does it make a difference how many followers they've got? Are you more inclined to hire a journalist who's got loads of followers? Because then that negates what you've just said. They're not doing it for attention. They're doing it, well, they are, but they're also doing it because their next boss is going to look at how many followers they've got.
Where's the proof that that is quality of your journalistic ability?
I'd be lying if I said it didn't, you know, it doesn't, or subconsciously doesn't play about, oh, look, they've got 100,000
followers.
Well, someone must like them. And again, but then I then have to kick in and then filter out whether they're any good as well. So that relies on me doing that. And
Two people are equally good and one's got 100,000 followers and one's got 10,000 followers, you're going to go for the one with the most followers.
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that, to be honest.
If they were equally good.
Not personally me doing that. I can see how that is something that others are weaker than I, weaker minded in positions of power.
Yeah, the Mick Booker.
But, you know, because I can spot them. So I can spot a good one or someone who's good. And again, I want the one who's going to go from 10,000 to 100,000. The one who's 100,000 could end up being 100,000. You know, I want growth.
There
I want to see
growth. Might be 50,000 bots for all you know.
Yeah. Like, no, exactly. Clearly, it's going to come into the thinking because that's where eyeballs are these days. They are on Twitter, they are on Instagram, they are on TikTok.
That's the Piers Morgan model, isn't it? Dare I say it, he has sort of, you know, 100 times, if not more, Twitter followers than viewers on his programme at the moment. You know, clearly he uses the platform to be divisive, controversial, and, you know, News UK don't just see him as a presenter of Talk TV. They see that content they can use, you know, on Fox Fox News, you know, content that can be used, I suppose, you know, in the Sun newspaper and that kind of stuff. And I suppose some people will look at that model, which has served him incredibly well. And obviously, look, you know, he's a talented individual, but, you know, he's obviously going to be the exception to the rule. But people see that, I suspect, and sort of think, yeah, that is the way forward.
We mentioned Trump briefly, but I don't think we can just leave it there, because Donald Trump sort of really redefined that immediate contact with the population, and it must have driven his people absolutely mad. I'll come to you, Andrew, first on that. I mean, this man would sit with a, you know, a branded sweet drink and a branded burger, and
McDonald's.
Yeah, we're not paid enough.
We're not paid
to say McDonald's. If we get paid to say McDonald's, we'll say McDonald's.
Burger King for balance.
Yeah, I like KFC for anyone.
But that must, for people like you guys, what were you like watching this coming out?
You have this moment of empathy for the idiot that is the communications director to the rotating cast of characters that were the director of communications for Donald Trump, because it's ungovernable, right?
Yeah.
Imagine that it's hard enough to shape a news agenda. It's hard enough to keep things on track. When you're waking, and he tweeted early too, right?
Yeah.
If you're waking up at 5:30 to 10 tweets that have fucked your day 8 ways from Sunday, and you know that whatever you had planned, whatever rollout you had, whatever announcement you had, whatever lunch plans you had, gone now, because the boss is shat all over social media. But that worked for him, because it made the journalists into his adversaries. And it wasn't just enough to chronicle the madness. They had to fight back. You know, your enemy, fake news, your enemy, the people. They would fight back again, as you would expect them to. But they took the bait and turned it into this dogfight between the president and the media. And again, that cannot be where journalism is.
Do you not think, Paul, I always looked on thinking the American press are much more deferential, though. So remember, I remember seeing him in the White House being filmed by NBC, and he goes, "I've had enough now." If that had been here, they'd have just carried on filming, right? Kicked them out halfway through. To Andrew's point, though, I mean, someone like him, I remember, like, he'd be tweeting during press briefings. So they'd be like, "What's the president's view on this?" They'd be like, "You say this. Oh, actually, he said this." You'd be like, "Oh, shit." And, you know, if you were working for him, you'd want to have taken his phone off him. It reminds me of one of my favorite stories, is John Prescott, who is known to have foot and mouth disease, one of the most gaffe-prone Labour politicians. His special advisor told me he used to sneak into his office when he wasn't there, when his phone was on his desk, and delete journalist numbers out of his phone to stop them calling, because it was a really, and this really sums up John Prescott's famous incident when he called up the Sun to berate them about a story, and there was a guy who was then political editor called George Pascoe Watson. He said, "I want to speak to George Pascoe Watson right now," and they were like, "I'm afraid he's not in today." He's like, no, but his name's on the paper. And he couldn't get his head around the fact that the story had been written yesterday, but it was in the paper today. But, I mean, it was kind of like on a very, like, mild level of Trump, you know, actually a nightmare when you have someone like that who's directly calling journalists, sounding off, and you can't control what's going on. And, I mean, Trump was so wild, wasn't he? So it wasn't like you could necessarily always...
He does impressions as well. Did you hear that?
I should have done that. It's terrible.
I'm so happy I worked for a prime minister that didn't have a mobile phone, didn't want a mobile phone.
No.
Was not...
Well, Boris Johnson said, didn't he, when he went, he said, if he'd switched Twitter off, he might have not got away with it, but he would have been... Well, he might have got away with it, yeah.
I don't think he used it.
But no, if Twitter had been switched off, he wouldn't have gone, would he? And there was that feeling, that febrile time, there was hysteria from the left, and a lot of left journalists as well, left-leaning journalists, many on on proper establishment brands of, you know, TV companies and newspapers, just going for him all the time and
should Twitter have the power to change the course of a government?
Well, I've started worry slightly that this place could become ungovernable because of social media platforms, just simply because of that constant churn of news and constant churn of disaster.
But it's actually not that many people, is it? Why is this the minority dictating the agenda?
Yeah. And
70% of us aren't on it in this country.
It's like an echo chamber. No PM or politicians should be looking at Twitter ever. They should not be spending their time whatsoever on this platform to watch. We've just said is an echo chamber and doesn't represent the public, and most of the public are far too busy getting on with their jobs than to be messing around.
Because even to that brand building point, it works for the politicians too. They do it to brand build. But in a system like Britons or Canada's. You're a constituency MP, right? Twitter is a platform that does not cater to the people in your constituency. Mm. Chances are 99% of them aren't on the platform. You're really playing to the Westminster bubble. And then the look that the world gets when something goes against the Twitter, like received wisdom on Twitter, we all look around like dogs that have just had their food changed and they don't know what's going on. And there's a confused look on their face. It's like real people don't live here. And if you're a politician, you care about real people. Remember, guys, real people, that's who you're there for. So get off these platforms.
But it is difficult as somebody, I have a very small Twitter profile. I only got one because somebody produced a fake one, so I had to put up a real one in order to stop.
I bet
somebody.
That was lively. Was that lively, Petri? That one.
That one was utterly racist. I mean, it was terrible, and I had no choice but to have it. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have one. But when you get, you know, 10 really nice tweets and one horrible one, it's the horrible one that you remember and you concentrate on. That is human nature. Yeah. So it is easy to see how, you know, 1,000 horrible tweets. It's only 1,000. Will change the course of somebody's thinking
about
themselves.
But as these two say, politicians shouldn't look at it, because every single one I've seen, the official tweet, even the official tweets, it's always resign, die, die, resign and die.
Mick, I just wanted to touch on the Trump thing with you from a journalist's point of view. That was sweet, wasn't it?
Well, it made
every time he tweeted, there were pages. I mean, you got loads of work out of it.
Because the world's so connected thanks to Twitter, then it makes everyone think that if you're living in Doncaster, you've got a say in what's happening in America. So it's interesting to you, or as some people would. And, you know, during that time as well, there was a Brexit thing. So there was people who supported Brexit, supported Trump, were all the populists, so-called, all got behind it. And it made... And he looked great. He was always stood in front of a flag as well, didn't he? So it was always great pictures. So his words that were coming out on Twitter, it looked great in newspapers. It looked great on the TV. And it all started with him tweeting every morning. We all felt we all lived in, like, greater America. So we had some sort of buy into it. Or we did in the media, whether some people in the real world actually, you know, there was probably quite a lot that didn't care. But I think there was quite a lot who just saw it as great, solid entertainment and didn't realise it could have ended with us all blowing up.
But that's an underappreciated point, I think, that Mick raised there about Twitter. Is it ruining journalism? In that it has expanded the field of play so much. So the editor of the local paper in Doncaster thinks he has to compete with Donald Trump's Twitter feed, when really it should be about the local council and what they're doing and not doing and what's going on that in that community. Because that's your value proposition, right? You're the only ones that care about that community. You're in the community. You know the community. You report on the community. And yet, thanks to this canvas that we have, we can all follow the crazy from wherever. And so editors think that, you know, I need clicks. And it's just the incentives the wrong way around. So that's another way it's ruined journalism. It reveals bias. It distracts from your patch and what you should be covering. And it makes the people involved in public life cater to the wrong incentives, namely fame and controversy instead of public policy and helping people.
It's killed off gossip columns, isn't it? Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple now. But, you know, because if something funny happens, everyone's like, oh, I've got to tweet it out, as opposed to wait for it being in the paper the next day. I mean, at least you knew with gossip columns there was a semblance of truth behind someone's stuff, usually.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it was based on something, whereas now obviously it just gets put on Twitter. So I think also from that perspective, it's a bit of a shame.
See, the beauty of the old gossip columns as well was you could stick a story in there, so it was on page, if the gossip column was across a spread on page 23, 24, there it is in the middle, and it could be a one line, the same size as a tweet. And it'd stay there and it wouldn't get expanded into a bigger story, because it could have ended up a bit more... If it had been expanded and people looked at it properly, it could have been libelous. But because it was buried away in that in there... But because of Twitter now, these things, you may tweet this thing and then suddenly this thing becomes bigger, and then suddenly this story that was just a little amusing thing, suddenly the rivets start popping on it and the story becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the end of it, you think, oh my God, what have I done? Whereas you could have just left it there, whereas Twitter, that one line explodes and goes everywhere. But in a gossip column, it's hidden and only a few people go, oh, I know that little secret.
Elon Musk, at the time of recording, has just taken over Twitter. He said that Donald Trump can come back to Twitter. So the purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk, what difference, Giles, do you think that's going to make to the platform?
I mean, he says that he's this, you know, ultimate free speech advocate, that he's going to exactly put people like Trump and other divisive people back on the platform. Maybe this is going too far, but it felt like, you know, nothing is off limits on there. But, you know, the problem with that also is Elon Musk himself, who I think, can't remember whether he was sued. I'm not sure whether they were successful, but
by the divers that rescued those Thai boys.
Maybe free speech, but it doesn't mean that you can be making libelous comments out there.
He referred to them as paedophiles, didn't he?
Exactly. So, you know, there should be some policing of it, because you shouldn't have people on there peddling hate. You shouldn't have people on there who are trying to fuel, you know, aggressive pylons. There have to be some parameters.
It's a scaling problem, right? Like, free speech, of course I support free speech. I work in a milieu of opinion, and you have to protect that. But the world didn't conceive of that in an age where that speech can go anywhere at the speed of light. And that's the thing. So these platforms like Twitter have never taken on their responsibility as platforms, as publishing platforms. There's no quality control or anything to that. And the accelerant that is there now, like everything can light on fire, to Mick's earlier point, in an instant. And we can't cope with that scale. We can't cope with the damage of that. So one man at the end of the bar in the pub who says something crazy, that's as far as it goes, like that pub, and maybe people go home and go, there's this crazy guy at the pub. Now that crazy guy at the pub can have 40 million followers, and to Giles' point, that hate or kind of crazy thought gets out there. So we haven't grappled with that either as a kind of tech industry or news industry or kind of information economy. And we have to find a way, because it's not the absolute principle, it's also the rate and speed at which that can be applied.
The narrative I've seen is the fact that Elon Musk takes over, gets the keys to Twitter, and that means that the lefty gatekeepers who have been muzzling right-wing free speech are gone, and he's going to save everyone. But, you know, as we speak, it's the morning, he's walked into that building with a sink under his arm or something like
that. Yeah, well, I don't understand that.
And, you know, my life hasn't got any better. I don't know about you lot. It's not as if he's changed the world with, you know, with this one act. And it's, you know, it's still a sewer, isn't it, Twitter? And it always will be. It just means that a few people...
It has given a platform to the guy in his boxer shorts in Darlington eating Doritos on the sofa.
Who nobody needs
watching,
to hear from.
You know, daytime TV, of which we don't need to hear.
Darlington Doritos boy.
Yeah. I've got a question for you, Mick. Have you ever been purposefully divisive or controversial on Twitter when you're a newspaper editor?
No, I was always...
Drive stuff.
I remember when I...
You're quite funny on Twitter,
very funny.
Quite funny.
Very funny.
Quite funny.
It's better on Facebook than Twitter.
I've always been scared of not having a job, right? Because when I first came down here, we had a really young kid, and I was earning about 10 grand a year, and I needed a house, right? So I've always thought, I'll try and keep holding my job, thanks. So when I was at the Daily Star Sunday and I started tweeting then, I was always very careful because I had a big billionaire boss who could get rid of me if he was upset. Then when I went to the Express, I had still had the big billionaire boss who I respected very much, and I didn't want to ruin...
Still respect.
And I still very respect a lot. You never know when they come in handy, but former big billionaire bosses. But no, yeah, I'll be banging on his big billionaire door one day. But no, it's... I can go on with this. I've always had a lot of respect for the people who bought the newspapers and the people who own the newspapers, and I didn't want to lose my job, so I've always been very, very, very careful as to what I tweet, because I think you've got to be, because it can ruin your entire life. You lose your job, and it loses respect for the place you work for. Even when I've done commentary on TV and things like that, again, I've always been very careful, because I don't want to annoy the readers, the viewers now of GB News, things like that, because, you know, if I lose their trust, then I may as well lose my job.
But if Twitter remains a sewer and gets worse and worse and worse, surely, is that not to the good in a way, bear with me, that people will stop believing in it, will stop taking what people say as nearly true or vaguely true?
I suppose it depends what the counterweight is, Petri. And so with the decline of the traditional news media, I worry that there's no alternate source of quality. And I think the history of mass communication, whether that's radio to TV to cable news to the internet, shows us that kind of the vegetables of the information world don't sell as well as the candy and sweets. And in that case, it's just hate and craziness. So I think some people will like it more. And I'd like to say that we're all noble creatures, but like, where's the evidence for that? And again, if you get back to what the kind of value proposition of this industry, of the news industry, is applying that judgment and quality control and qualifying information before it gets out there. So until we find some way to get that back in there, kind of what happens on the platform is a given for me. It will devolve into the lowest common denominator.
I mean, here's your irony about Twitter. I'm pretty sure it's never made any money as a business. And of course, now that doesn't matter, because Elon Musk can have it as a loss-making venture. So to your point, it's probably here for as long as he's got it.
I think they were squeaking into profit. Or
really?
Like, yeah, they were getting there.
I thought they'd hit a ceiling and they hadn't made money. They certainly hadn't made much.
It's all going to be TikTok's world in about a week and a half. Well, I mean, like, if you look at the results and advertising dollars.
That's where it's going.
They're beating Google and Meta. Sorry, Facebook. They're still terrible Facebook, everybody. Don't forget.
One thing I want to ask.
Terrible Facebook.
Before we go on to the PR cock-up of the week, and I think there are plenty of them. Why do people think that freedom of speech means that they can say anything? I've had people, for my opinion, tweet me and say that I should be raped because of my opinion. Now, that's quite a common thing for women to get on these platforms, be put back in my place, all of these awful, awful things. And they think that's freedom of speech.
Well, as Andrew says, human beings aren't particularly very nice anyway. Stick them in a room on their own with the phone and they think that, oh, there's Petri Hoskin, or the profile that think that is the real Petri Hoskin anyway, not the racist one. But that they can have a go back and you're not going to be able to have a go back proper. You know, I think it's opened
up. But it's
up
disgusting.
That.
It's my job.
No, it's horrible.
But do you not think, I mean, one thing I've often thought was that they should make everyone verify themselves on Twitter. So you should put a picture up. So if you want to make these heinous, awful comments, you have to justify them and you have to face it up. Because the problem is, you still have this issue where people can hide behind anonymous accounts, which is disgraceful. And that actually is, Twitter could change that to their detriment. You might stop, or you'd certainly put a level on how far you go into the sewer.
Yeah, because, I mean, ultimately, it's harder to say something to somebody's face.
They would never say anything like that to my face.
Yeah, well, the balls section. Absolutely not.
No, and again, that gets to the financial imperative. Like, these networks need to show user growth and ad revenue growth to survive. And
so they don't care that I'm being threatened with rape?
No, they don't. The imperative is not to police that kind of stuff. It's not, because society hasn't clapped back. And that's the other thing, that one person's complaint in the sea of noise.
But you know what it all goes back to? It's that one little like you get. The little heart goes and someone likes you.
I don't care. As long as they like my dog, that's fine by me. All right, let's move on to the PR cock-up of the week. Giles, let's take you.
Rishi Sunak, and as we're talking, has just been Prime Minister for whatever it is, 3 or 4 days.
That's quite long.
Reappointing, it is in this day and age, Suella Braverman as the Home Secretary, who seems to have, allegedly, apparently, breached security protocol on multiple occasions, has been given lessons by MI5 how to,
not
follow the right
security procedures.
Yeah,
email account.
And it seems like, that is an accident waiting to happen. Now, when you have a Prime Minister who stands up and says, I'm going to restore integrity to public life, have high levels of accountability and transparency, he then reappoints Home Secretary, who was fired 7 days before for breaching.
I thought she quit, fired.
I mean, generally, I think she got fired, having committed multiple breaches of the ministerial code. To me, that is an incredibly, I think it's an incredibly
stupid thing to have done. Surely a deal was done.
And I suppose
if she quit, and we wonder why nobody likes politics.
I'm sure a deal was done. But then, and I'm sure there may be a calculation is like, well, she will probably implode and she'll have to stand down of her own volition. Oh, then we can put someone in there, who we want. But yeah, I mean, to me, it's all relative. Everyone's going, oh, he's really, really slick. I mean, ish, compared to what came before. But what had been a relatively smooth, should we say, transition of power and smooth start, it seems to be like a unnecessary and pointless thing to do.
But the one that I was going to say, and again, it's related to Rishi Sunak and it's part of the government comms of the first week. But as you'd say with Suella Braverman, not going to COP for the climate change shindig that they're going to have. Now, that is supposed to be a great big cock-up, isn't it? And I mean, how terrible it is. But again, related to the Suella Braverman one, you flip them both over, there's a lot of people on the right who say that's exactly the right thing to do. The base who are actually voting for you don't care about climate change. They love Suella Braverman. You've done exactly the right thing. And it's a genius move to that side. And again, that is fueled on the narrative on Twitter as well.
Don't bow. They'll be like, two fingers to the establishment. Don't bow down
to them. I remember watching the last COP And when it was on in this, I think it was on every single news channel. It was on a Saturday night, and Alex Sharma started crying.
You're exciting, aren't you, on a Saturday night watching Cop?
Well, no, but no, I was editing the Sunday Express, trying not to put it in the newspaper, desperately trying to find the reasons not to, but you kind of had to. And it moved from 4 and 5 to 6 and 7 to 8 and 9. I think, yeah, we've got it on 10 and 11. That's, I don't think most of our readers at that point cared less about, yeah, you know, the, I was out burning tyres the night before in my back garden, all that. But it was,
you were.
I do care dearly about the climate, but I think it is that, it's that flip of it, and it's people found it really, really boring, and it was something that people grandstanded about. Yes, we care about the climate. Yes, but at the same time, with Suella Braverman, look, she may have done something wrong, but she's clamping down on migrants coming across the channel.
Is she then?
And,
is
well,
she
that's what we expect her to do. You know, she hasn't had the chance to do that. She's left a job once without doing anything. Now she's give her a chance, and I think that is the flip side of that. Whereas on the right, it's not a total gaffe. It's a fantastic PR thing to do.
Wow. Andrew?
Yeah, I was like, I'm going to call him Kanye West because I don't care to go for his new branded name. Yeah. Yay, I'm an anti-Semite. look, if you're a brand and you're doing, like, business with mentally ill people, you got to factor that in.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't say that to be cruel to Kanye West, but he's not well. He hasn't been well for a while. And it's sad to watch brands try to... And Adidas hung on for like way longer than anybody
else.
But
have you seen Yeezy shoes? They're terrible shoes as well. They should have been banned years ago.
What colour are his shoes?
Well, they're any colour, but they're just disgustingly designed. They don't look like shoes. Some of them look like an alien just strapped around your foot.
Yeah, but
you're not the market, Mick. I hate to tell you this. You're not the demographic he's aiming for.
I'm still young.
No, you're not.
I'm clinging on me hair.
You know, it's this thing that people think that this is, you know, bringing credibility to my business, like the lure of celebrity. But you have to apply a filter there. You have to realize that when you're
credible and moral, good lord.
Well, you know, and we'll be into this too with FIFA and the World Cup. It's like, you know,
oh wow, yeah, that's
should a business endorse it? Well, like, look, let the governments connect. They didn't pick Qatar. The tournament's there. There's going to be a trillion people watching. You'd be malpractice not to
cleverly did say
that
to any
just don't be too gay.
Yeah, just don't be too gay. That was my PR cop up for the week. Guys, thank you very much indeed. It's been absolutely fantastic as ever. Thanks to Mick, Giles and Andrew. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. And if you want to see pictures of my dog, then please do join me on the real Twitter at Petri Hoskin. Goodbye for now. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.